You're listening to the Deeply Graphic Design Cast, the show about all things design, from the creative side to the business side and all points in between. Follow the show on Twitter at Wes McDowell. Want the gang to answer your question on an upcoming episode? Send in your listener question to questions@thedeependesign.com or via Twitter using hashtag DGDC. Here are your hosts.
Wes McDowell in Chicago.
Mikkel Morrison in Seattle.
Nick Longo in Los Angeles.
All right, back together again, and want to thank everybody for continuing to listen and for telling a friend. We love it. We've been getting some more five-star reviews on iTunes, which warms my heart to see that.
I wish there was a way we can reply back. It's like it always says, I hope you guys read this, and we are, trust me.
And we did get a recent two-star review from someone who said they love the show, but they feel like we only put one out every 5 weeks. I beg to differ. It's every 2 weeks.
Two a month.
How about you bump that two up to five? You like the show? We're working hard for you here.
Oh, that's sweet though, because that individual thinks feels like there's too much time in between, and it feels like five as opposed to two.
That's true. Good. It's a good sign.
That means we give them time to miss us, which is leave them wanting more. I say, right? The worst would be like we do it every day, and they're like, God, shut up already.
Yeah, exactly. Enough with the weather in Chicago. My God.
Oh, my God. What are you guys up to? Anything good happen this week?
Oh, I'm just, again, it's glad it's Friday. I love recording on Friday with you guys. That's great. It's a good day. School's doing well, and they're just getting ready for portfolio review, which is coming up a month from today. So That's always a fun spot to be in as a student, design student, is getting your portfolio ready for the first time. Remember that?
The critiques.
Yeah, that's exciting and totally stressful. I remember.
It is. Yeah. It is. And so I'm just loving it. But we have about 50 reviewers coming out in about a month, and they spend the whole day together. So it'll be fun. I can't wait for it.
That's cool.
One of those. Yeah. I might just blend in and bring my portfolio.
There you go.
Why not? Imposter.
Just like put on a hat and some sunglasses and pretend to be a student.
Exactly. How's everything with you guys?
Yeah, good. We just got back from Chelan last night, and so it's unpacking and repacking because I take off for Camino Island shortly.
Where are all these exotic places you're going?
Yeah.
No, Cabo's exotic.
Eastern Washington is not exotic. Oh, Eastern Washington. Okay.
We were at Lake Chelan to see family, and we took an RV over, and we just got back, and now I leave for girls' weekend, and I drop off Oakley at school this morning, and he's in tears. So I'm trying to get
over
it still.
Guilty mom syndrome now, right?
You got to give him a chance to miss you. You don't want too much mom time. That's no good.
If there's one lesson in today's episode.
It'll be so interesting to hear you say that when you're a dad someday.
I don't know if that'll ever happen, but I'll let you know. I'll keep you posted.
You never know.
But But to continue the tradition of last week telling you about the terrible show I saw, I have a good one I saw this week. I don't know if you guys watch the show Crazy Ex-Girlfriend on the CW. It's hilarious, and it's on Netflix. Anyone who doesn't watch it should watch it. It's hilarious. It's a musical, but it's funny. It's like Book of Mormon style kind of funny.
Yeah.
And they did they're like touring right now doing little shows, the whole cast singing a lot of the songs from the show. So we went there the other night.
Cool.
And it was, yeah.
So you're so good about attending this stuff. Like hard-earned money goes to these musicals.
Well, this was just kind of a concert, more or less.
It's Wes keeping the arts alive. That's what it is.
Exactly.
Come on.
I'm on the arts control. But no, if you want to get your feet wet in the show, it's on Netflix. And just do yourself a favor and YouTube First Penis I Saw. It is delightful. It's one of the funniest songs from the show.
Oh, okay.
So it's a good entry point.
Wes's picks. I love it.
Yeah.
I just heard, what's her name from Saturday Night Live? Tina Fey being interviewed for performing on stage Mean Girls. Yeah, that's getting really good reviews already.
Yeah, I saw it. It was great. But anyway, enough Broadway and CW musical talk. It's time to talk about Skillshare. Skillshare is amazing. We love them. I love them particularly. Whenever it comes time to learn a new skill or a new software, right now I'm using it to learn what I've talked about in the show before. Yeah, Adobe XD, the new web design program. It's like kind of the Sketch alternative.
Yep.
I'm going to Skillshare to learn that. So they have everything all in one place. They're an online learning platform with over 18,000 classes in graphic design, logo design, illustration, and everything else. And it's growing all the time. So for instance, to little foreshadowing for our show today, we're going to be talking some packaging design. And I did a little search on Skillshare. They've got so many packaging design courses, like one called the Dyeline put out called Packaging Design, Sketching Concepts That Surprise and Delight. So you can learn that the first class is the surprising and the second course is the delighting. So yeah. You got it all there. But there's, I'm looking at about 30 or even more courses all about packaging design.
Oh, there's tons.
Just to show you.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they've got it all is the point. But anyway, we have worked out a deal just for our listeners. You can get 2 months of Skillshare for just 99 cents. That is right. Can you believe it? Skillshare is offering our listeners 2 months of unlimited access to the over 18,000 classes for less than a dollar, one penny under a dollar to be exact, 99 cents. So to sign up, go to skillshare.com/graphic. Again, go to skillshare.com/graphic. To start your 2 months now, that's skillshare.com/graphic.
Cool.
All right. So today we're continuing right along with our little mini-series of design niche spotlights. So today we have a special guest, Stephen Cox, with us, and he works with Daemon. It's a company called Daemon.com, and they do all the private brand design. So welcome, Stephen.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Yeah. So, yeah, why don't you go ahead and give us a rundown for our listeners, what exactly you do and what Daemon does and how you fit into it.
Sure. Yeah, so Daemon, you know, Daemon's been working with private brand since, you know, the early 70s, you know, kind of back when the thought of private brand was really more of the generic packaging, like the yellow label with the black type on it, and everything kind of looked the same and super
plain wrap.
Yeah, exactly. you know, like... Luckily for me, you know, I wasn't really around at that point, kind of rooted into this career, but yeah, so, you know, my focus is really from the branding side of private brand design and really developing the branding strategies and packaging for these retailers. Yeah.
Okay. So why don't you, for the benefit of our listeners, we already talked about it off air, but why don't you go ahead and let everybody know exactly what you mean by private brands?
Sure. So, you know, historically, private brands are kind of, you know, retailer owned. So, you know, they would have the retailer's brand mark on it. That strategy is certainly changing, and there are other brands that the retailers are now developing that that are really more endorsed by a retailer as opposed to you know, kind of really having that brand mark that's on the side of the store be front and center. So really, you know, our job is to really kind of develop the strategies and executions that kind of help them position their brands in the marketplace, you know, next to all of the brands that everybody knows and loves and kind of carve out their little, you know, niche on the shelf.
Yeah. It's probably great to maybe even highlight, like you were mentioning earlier too, the Up and Up brand at Target is like a great example of what a private label might be like at a particular retailer. And then, like you were saying too, the tiers they have even a nicer one, Market Pantry, right? And like other ones.
Like, and it's a Archer Farms.
Yeah.
I don't know if they still have that.
Yeah. And in fact, that's their way of kind of differentiating them, you know, low, mid and high, but you're right. They have to compete with the big league players right next to them, but it's not primarily like with the Target logo on it, but it's the brand that you have helped them create. Correct.
Yeah, and you know, the strategies really do change from retailer to retailer, and some do really go with the kind of, you know, economy brand, the mid-level brand, and then that really premium brand. Some retailers really kind of, you know, develop brands based on consumer lifestyle, so they might have a very, like, natural and organic brand that, you know, speaks to a certain consumer type. So the strategies are really... very broad and can kind of go and reach different consumers, different markets. And that's part of the reason why I really enjoy it is the flexibility of that, that kind of strategic approach is really something that kind of grabbed me pretty early on.
And it's quite a challenge too, I bet, having to not only start something new, but represent a previous brand in a good way too, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, some they're all different, right? So like, just like any other, you know, branding, packaging, exploratory, you know, you typically inherit the good and bad assets and equities that come along with it. So, you know, for any of these brands, when we're really trying to position it to the right consumer target, you know, it's really about pulling it apart and really kind of teasing out the assets that consumers like and want to see carry forward, and then, you know, kind of evolving the other ones to you know, to leave back what they're kind of gonna like grow away from.
Got it. Cool. How'd you get into this? I'm curious. I think that's like a good question to start with, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my you know, my entry into private brand actually started pretty early on. You know, I kind of came out of school with a pretty good understanding of packaging really being the area of design that I wanted to focus on. You know, I kind of started out in an era when you know, annual reports were really kind of a big deal, mm-hmm. for people to design. So you know, for me it was like, it's 20 pages of really cool like handcrafted art and you know, illustrations and typography, followed by, you know, 200 pages of you know, columns of text and numbers, yeah. Which really
thank God that thank God that's all changed.
Yeah, that wasn't super exciting once you got to the back half for me. So you know, pretty early on, I was handed a packaging project, and the ability to like really think through a challenge in kind of a 3D form was something that really, mm-hmm. kind of gravitated towards that a lot. So one of my first kind of entries into the professional world was actually at Damon, where I'm currently now. And I didn't really know anything about private brand at the time, so it was really, I kind of just happened upon it. But I really always kind of looked at private brand, at least early on, as kind of the stepping stone for, you know, what I really wanted to do at the time, which was get into you know, national brands that really work with the big guys that were out there. So, you know, that was kind of how I entered in. You know, I ended up moving into kind of Manhattan and working my way through some of the bigger, you know, branding agencies that are in Manhattan. And, you know, I got the exposure that I always thought I wanted. And mm-hmm. I worked with the big brands like Nestle and Butterfinger and Schweppes and all those guys. And it was great. While I was at these other branding agencies, there was always at least one private brand, you know, different clients that was always kind of around and kind of followed me. So it just kind of stuck around, and I was probably about 12 years into my career before I realized that the thing that followed me was actually really where my passion lied. Mm-hmm. And it's really been the last kind of 5 years that I've kind of circled back and really made kind of the commitment to private brand from a design perspective to be really more of my focus.
Nice.
So did you seek out this company because it was in that space, or did it just kind of happen naturally?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I started really early on in my career at Damon, kind of left and went out and kind of explored and did a bunch of other things. All within packaging and branding. And then when I really made the decision to be specifically focused in private brand design, you know, I identified a couple companies that are really focused on that as a discipline, and Damon's one of them. So, you know, it's pretty rare to find an agency that is kind of solely focused in one area. So that was kind of one major factor that really drove me back to this particular agency environment.
Neat.
So, you know, that's kind of what, and you know, the opportunity here just happened to align with you know, with other things that were going on in my career. So it was kind of the perfect balance of you know, the right brand mix, the right agency environment, and you know, kind of the right time in my career.
Good. Yeah, it's a mixture of all of them, really.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah. So what about that, the private label or the private brand stuff draws you more than if you were just to do packaging, mm-hmm. for other brands?
Sure.
What about that intrigues you so much?
Yeah, you know, this is an industry that just, it continues to evolve. You know, like I kind of mentioned before, it really did start out as the generic version of you know, what you would want to buy. And it was really just a cost-driven solution. And, you know, in the, that was probably 70s, 80s.
I mean, those products used to be like the butt of every joke.
Yeah, you know? Exactly.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
The generics.
Yeah, yep. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Sure.
And you're right. It was all about value. It had nothing to do with design.
I remember, going to my grandparents' house and they always had like the big bag of cereal.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Versus the box. And like, that's how you know that it was.
You're like, where's Toucan Sam? He's not here.
Yeah. It was like,
yeah, it's not considered the cheap, you're being cheap route anymore. It's not like how it used to be in that regard.
Yeah. No.
And I also think and I'd be curious about this. Aren't consumers they're more aware now that these generic brands are probably produced on the same exact lines that the big brands are. In fact, sometimes they're produced by the big brands. So I think we're getting smarter to know if it's an attractive looking package and the cost is better. Right. And we know the quality is going to be good. Well, it's kind of a win-win-win, right?
If one more person tells me how, you know, Costco's vodka is the same as Grey Goose, I'm going to lose it. I know.
I just can't put a Kirkland bottle on my bar.
Kirkland's you guys are exactly example. Right with that. They, you know, the quality has certainly, you know, stepped up all the way to, you know, equal to national brands at this point. I think consumers are smarter and more aware of that and just in general, right? I think they're more willing to kind of do their homework beforehand, kind of read the label.
Right.
Yeah, so I think the playing field has equaled out in terms of quality of product. You know, and now it's really just the same kind of, you know, how do we connect to a consumer's lifestyle, you know, just like the big brands have to do.
Yeah. Because everyone wants volume, and that's probably one of the better ways to do it, because you have an instant kind of sell-through because of all the locations that your client probably has. So it makes sense, because it's not like you're having to launch a brand really the traditional way. It's already in stores because the store made it, you know?
Yeah, yep, right.
And I have to wonder if... you know, the work you guys do in making these store brands, these quote generic brands, look like they can compete against the name brands. I wonder if that has had anything to do with the consumer's perception that we're talking about the quality. Yeah. I'm sure the quality of the products have gone up too, but I think that the work you guys do, the packaging aspect, probably has a lot to do with people buying more of it, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I mean, there's a significant, you know, kind of focus now on the brand and kind of the creative that goes into the package design that wasn't really there in the early days of private brand, right? It would just from the retailer's perspective, that wasn't how they were going to look to position it. It was really all about value. And if they just cut out all of the overhead, that's the way they could bring the value, right? All of the brands that we work with and the retailers and, you know, they certainly have a huge focus on kind of the strategy of developing a brand. And it's really a focus of theirs. So, you know, obviously they allow us the ability to kind of, you know, stretch into different creative areas, way more than they ever have before, which is a great thing.
What would you, I imagine the biggest challenge would be the fact that you're creating a brand that has to be super flexible for any future product or SKU down the road, right? And every type of packaging. So what are the things you really zero in on to make sure that the brand is consistent throughout its entire collection?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, you know, the brands really do run the gamut, right? So there are some that really want that high level of connectivity across the entire store.
Yeah.
So from an architectural perspective or even a typographic perspective, they're really doing things that are kind of consistent across the, you know, the entire store landscape from category to category, whether you're in a frozen cooler or your kind of center store cereal, you know, cans of soup, they're all going to look kind of the same. And that's just a strategy that they, you know, that they feel like deploying.
Yeah.
Because they, you know, they're trying to build their kind of store banner. And then you have other retailers that really kind of embody the spirit of every category as a one-off, right? And they're really using their brand mark as a little badge of quality. But they're really letting the products kind of compete in their own. So, you know, if you're going up against, Captain Crunch and you know, you got to have your own kind of look and feel and personality that is equally as enticing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is it okay for you to share what, you know, we keep talking and envisioning these shelf items that are more physically based, and would it be all right if you shared those in the e-com space?
Yeah. I mean,
that you work with?
Absolutely. I mean, we do, you know, we work with some e-com retailers, you know, Fresh Direct, which has to, you know, kind of compete in an online environment only.
Sure.
Yeah.
So, you know, we were constantly doing things a little bit differently for their packaging than we would a brick and mortar store.
Right.
You know, given that they, you know, they land in a different kind of virtual shelf. So, you know, the consumer really is looking at the graphics in a different way. Because they don't.
So the
need
whole
to
marketing strategy is distinct in that respect, right?
Yeah, yeah, and I think the biggest challenge
That's so cool.
right now is for the, you know, the brick and mortar stores, they're so used to doing it one way. And now for them to transition into thinking about how they get their products you know, to deliver to consumers in a different channel is certainly something that's probably their next biggest hurdle, in my opinion.
Okay. What would you say is the most interesting part of this for you, of your specialty, the niche?
You know, the most interesting thing for me is really the creative freedom that happens from category to category. So, you know, and I think a lot of that has just happened over time, where retailers are moving away from kind of the, you know, the every category looking the same, every product looking the same, and really kind of pushing the boundaries for any specific category, right? So that for me is really where the interest lies. You know, and on top of that, you know, they're super open to kind of pushing the boundaries too, because they're not the typical brand that has a lot of, you know, brand assets in one category. You know, like if you're you know, a spring water, you know, you kind of have developed your brand over time, and kind of consumers know what to expect. You know, if you're Dasani, it's going to be blue. If you made it red, you'd probably lose some consumer share there.
Sure.
You know, our guys are, you know, they're more open to kind of being different in some ways, because they, you know, they have you in the store and their brand mark is on the side of the store. So they don't have to work as hard, you know.
It's going to be back behind the store for sure. It's got all of its support. Yeah. Interesting. So like, you mentioned that too, with the clients that you're dealing with in these stores, let's say, do you find there's an advantage to the fact that you are working with them on something that is their own brand, as opposed to maybe some of these bigger brands that are so cautious about what they have to put on the shelf, and you know, is it a better relationship when it comes to the creative process?
Yeah, I don't know if it's, you know, in my experience, I don't know that it's been better, but certainly been different, right? You know, I think they all run into the same challenges, right? It's really about, how do I connect with my consumer? Their consumer just happens to be more regionally driven. You know, so a retailer in Northern California is going to have, you know, kind of different benefits and things that are important to their lifestyle than, you know, you will find in Texas. So, and I think that's part of the fun for me too, is that, you know, I kind of get to treat every brand super different, just based on the regional and kind of cultural things that are happening in that region.
You get to be more specific with kind of who you're reaching and then the design you're going to build for it.
Yeah.
I like that.
How does that research go? Like, how do you put, if you live in Connecticut, right?
Yes.
Okay. So how do you put yourself kind of in the shoes of a Oklahoma or someone who lives in the Pacific Northwest?
The discovery phase has got to be fascinating. Like?
No, yeah, kidding. So it's pretty interesting, and we have you know, we have a lot of we have a large field team, so people who are from those areas, and they work with the retailers on, you know, marketing and other kind of, you know, areas for their brand. So, you know, we do have kind of the experts in those regions that we can pull from. You know, we will deploy testing and that kind of thing just to validate. But, you know, for the most part, you know, part of the benefit that I have worked for a large agency is that, you know, I have those resources that are kind of in all of our, you know, regional offices. So, you know, we can kind of have access to all that data at a, you know, pretty quick glance.
Okay. And then it's just about putting yourself into that kind of situation, reading the brief of what they give you and communicating as best as possible.
Yeah. I mean, you know, just like any other, you know, branding initiative, right? It's really about creating a visual interpretation of all the data, right? So if it's a health driven product, you know, how do you bring that to life in, you know, the most clean and concise way? And, you know, where if it's something that is in a different part of the country that is more in like of an indulgence driven product, you know, clearly there's a different visual communication there.
Okay,
cool. So how big is your creative services team?
So, you know, we kind of run the beginning to end with brand strategy all the way through execution and production. So we, you know, our team is about 60 people total.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my team, you know, being just the design portion of it, really kind of focusing on the branding and creative, is about 10 people.
Great.
Okay, cool.
And do they get to see it through the whole process, like in an individual, or does it go through teams of like development, process, revisions, production, or how does it work?
Yeah, so the you know, our system is probably a little bit different, where we really do give you know, kind of each retailer their own kind of hub team.
Good.
You know, cool. where they become really the brand ambassadors for that brand.
Mm-hmm.
It really does help them get grounded in kind of the region they live in, you know, the aesthetic that the brand is kind of trying to achieve.
Yeah.
So that's it, you know, within our company is kind of being a specialty niche of you know, developing private brands. You know, kind of each design team has a lead for each retailer that really is kind of the specialty niche is that particular brand's DNA.
Nice.
Okay. So you've got a team of 10 people.
Yep.
So each one of you on that team kind of is the lead of one of the brands, is
projects.
That what I'm understanding? Or
yep. So one of the brands.
Okay.
And you know, because we'll work.
You know, that makes sense. I'm sure that's a healthy way to proceed, because otherwise you get distracted by all the other projects that are coming around in house.
Yeah.
And there could be some conflict there, so it allows that team of ambassadors. I like that you named it ambassadors as an analogy. I think that's perfect, because then they sort of own it. It becomes their bread and butter, and they don't get misled or distracted with the other projects incoming. Yeah.
And the client's going to love it too, because of the focused
you just
you know,
own
attention.
It. You own it.
And I think that's always been one of the better ways for, I'm so happy to hear you guys got a good size art department. I think I've been hearing lately more and more of these places shrinking down to just a few managers and directors, and everything's a freelance based and or hired subcontractors. Like, certain times companies like that really deserve the full-time help and a good team of people to really empower them, you know? That's great.
Yeah. I mean, you know, for some of the retailers, we're designing probably, 800 to 1,000 packs, SKUs per year. So, you know, some of the programs are large and, you know, the retailer really, I think, benefits a lot from having kind of that single point of contact and really developing kind of a working relationship with the designer who's physically working on their brand. Right.
Yeah.
So each ambassador, like, let's say you own one brand and then all your colleagues each own another brand. Do you work on everything for that brand yourself, or do you have kind of a sub team under you that does production of?
Yeah.
I'm just kind of trying to visualize how that all works out.
Yeah. So we as the kind of creative team, designers really do set the look and feel for, you know, for each category that comes through. And then, you know, and then at some point we will hand it off to the production team that will kind of, you know, blow out the line extensions and kind of roll out the whole program and really kind of, you know, make everything into a full functioning mechanical that's print ready that we can give to the printer and you know, and they're off to running, you know, print, pack, and ship and all that stuff. But throughout that mechanical process and working with the production team, and the, you know, we have an in-house photo studio, so there's probably a lot of different pieces and parts that are kind of working kind of simultaneously. And it's it's really the designer's job to be the consistent, right? So they're kind of overseeing the project from beginning to end, even though they might not be physically doing every stage.
Right. Yeah. Okay. That's good.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you work with, are your vendor relationships all local there?
No, actually most of them are global. Yeah. So our suppliers are kind of all over. You know, some are international, some are domestic, but yeah, our network of kind of vendors is huge, and we really do kind of rely on the people here in our office to kind of be the consistent kind of glue throughout the project.
Neat. That's great. What's the most challenging part of this whole process of being a bit of a specialty here, and the fact that you guys are always working on private labels? What's the biggest challenge?
You know, I think the biggest challenge is probably you know, being put in a box, right? So
literally
exactly, right? So as soon as,
more ways than one.
As soon as you know, as soon as anybody hears that you know, you work specifically for private brands or private label or own brands, or you know, they've changed names and stuff over the years, it just becomes immediately like, you know, you can only do that one thing. Which is, I don't think, untypical for you know, other aspects of design. Whether if you're a web designer,
it's a specialty.
Design, so,
sure.
You know, I think for some people that's a challenge. I'll be honest with you, and part of what I like about private brands is that I love when people think that I'm the underdog and I can only do one or two things. It's like the fuel feeling for me that. Like, I'll stop at nothing to prove them wrong. So
that's awesome.
So I think that's part of why this particular
motivation
design niche works for me. You know, I don't know if everybody probably thinks that same way or not, but that's kind of a driving force for me anyway.
But I don't think a lot of people can say that. It's more like, regardless of where you're in or what you do, as long as you have that continual like push to be creative and change the game every time, like that's a good thing to have. I think a lot of any creative that has that is truly lucky, you know?
Sure.
I think that makes all the difference in the world, because you got all the other factors, the pay, the commutes, the team you work with. But to have that is a great thing to start with, you know?
Yeah. Yep.
Cool.
Yeah. I agree.
And it's the eternal struggle of the niche designer, basically.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Some people might, you could say I'm pigeonholed, or you can embrace it and say, I'm a specialist in this thing.
Yeah.
You know, so I think it's all kind of in how you look at it. So I would encourage anyone listening who's thinking about getting into a niche, don't think of yourself as, well, gee, I can only do this one thing, or people only think I can do this one thing. Mm-hmm. Embrace the positive of it, which is, damn, I'm a specialist in this one thing, and I do it better than anybody,
right?
Or whatever, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I've had other people, you know, along the way say, well, you know, I don't think you can, you know, you guys can't possibly do, you know, national brand design because you only do private brand design.
But so naive.
Yeah,
that's dumb. Yeah,
yeah. And
that's ego, I think. If you really think.
Yeah, that's 100%. Come on. Right? Because I think at the end of the day, for most of us, like we, you know, I didn't land in this niche because it was the only thing I could do. Right? I landed here because it was a conscious decision of where I thought I could bring the most value to my, you know, to my client base. Right.
There you go.
Yeah. So let me ask you this. Where do you see this whole industry of the private brand specialty going?
So, you know,
long term.
Yeah, I mean, it's growing. It's growing faster than, you know, many other kind of, you know, branding segments in terms of packaging. So and most of that's just really because of the players that are entering the game. Right. So, you know, as soon as Amazon and Jet got into the game changed, right? And it got a lot bigger.
Did you see Jet's private label brand, by the way?
I actually, if you haven't
seen that, it is gorgeous.
It really is.
Yep. Probably one of the better ones that are out there. I think the Dieline did a great little article on it a while back. So Jet being like Amazon, selling everybody else's products for a great price, designed their own private label brand. And it's called
You by Jet.
Oh, look that up. It is, I mean, and they use some of the top illustrators, top like branding designers out there, you know, and then I think they did it, I think mostly in-house after that, but that's a perfect example of where this industry is going, I think. And then Amazon as well with their store and probably, and the integration with Whole Foods. It'll be interesting to see what happens there.
Yeah, I'm super curious about that.
And also too, I think it's worth saying in this conversation, look at Trader Joe's. Trader Joe's is exactly that.
Yeah.
They don't make a single thing in that store.
No.
It is all private label. Yep. And so it's a whole store private label. And what a job they've done. They've stuck to their guns, you know, like they haven't really evolved. There's a question of maybe they should. I don't know what your thought is on that, Steven, but gosh, you know, they're killing it. I mean, it's, and you know, I know people who produce stuff for them, and the pricing they get just makes it worth going there and getting it. And it's still fun design. They have fun with it.
The box for Gorilla Munch cereal just continues to inspire to this day.
Yeah. They're certainly one of the leaders. They adapted that strategy for themselves to be kind of quirky and fun. And that's just been their, it's been their thing. If I was in that organization, I don't know that I would change that at this point. They're certainly doing a great
business.
I know.
I was just going to say it works for them. It's why they've got the successful reputation that they do.
Yeah. Exactly.
Oh, and it's so consistent with their other branding, like just the way you're treated in the store. Like it's all very
totally. Totally. Yeah.
I think another
one to see them go any sleeker. I don't know.
Yeah.
Wouldn't work.
No, and I think that's, you know, that's probably true for a lot of brands or private brands, right? Like you know, the brand personality really should match the physical personality. You know, and I think Trader Joe's did a great job of that, right? So that you kind of get the branding visual the second you're in the store.
Yeah.
What an interesting challenge though. Yeah.
Oh, I had a friend that worked she did packaging out here in their office for Trader Joe's for many years. And she said, in some ways it was, because it was so established and it didn't change. And Steven, you could probably talk to this. It became kind of a churn and burn thing because it was just one client, the same thing. And it was like, get it on shelves as fast as possible.
Well, and that does, that does happen, but it's part of the nature of developing, you know, a program like Trader Joe's, who's going to have to cover 3,000 SKUs across the entire store, that takes time to execute, right? So while they're coming up with the brand strategy and it's, you know, super fun and kind of new and exciting at first, it does take time to roll it all out. So it does become kind of the, you know, the name of the game after the initial strategy is launched is really about brand consistency, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to ask, because you say like some of these brands require like 800 SKUs a year. How quick do you have to turn around?
You know, again, kind of the upfront we do is really kind of setting the look and feel, establishing the brand like architecture, the guidelines. And kind of the guidelines and consistency. And sometimes it's really just about a logo placement and everything else is kind of a one-off. But you know, we'll try to do as much as we can up front to really kind of think through the entire store format and make sure that we can accommodate, you know, different printing challenges that might happen in, you know, kind of, areas of the store that are historically, you know, can't represent the graphics the same way. Like, you know, sour cream and like, you know, kind of those plastic tubs versus, you know, the full color box. So it's a lot of it is that planning phase, right? Yeah.
I was going to say another one I'm sure you and you're aware of, but would be a great case study for listeners to look at. Have you guys seen Brandless?
No. Yeah. So Brandless was one.
It's 100% online private label. Like it's, if you look at brandless.com, it's so simple and clean, very fresh. Remember, what was it? Fresh and Easy. Was the Tesco brand that came out here for a while? Very similar to that, kind of generic.
Yeah. Take a look at it. And it's got its own app that's super clean as well. Yes. And just to look at discount. Yeah. Interesting concept.
It's based on how you purchase. If you buy two or three SKUs, there's like a set shipping rate or something. It's so simple and clean. And like you're saying, so when you talk about the future of this thing, like that is really where it's going. And it, what an integration they've done with online. And that's the, that was the, when I saw that, that's what sparked the private label project that I did in my class with my packaging students. So I love seeing that this stuff is doing, and it was a challenge, man. Cause I think anybody who's looking for something to try to do, try to do what Steven does on a daily basis for one time. And you'll see it's a huge challenge because you're playing with, you're right next to the big boys, you know, and you gotta look just as good, and just as appetizing now. You can't make it just generic anymore.
Yeah. That's 100% right. Yep.
White box and big black letters are not going to look anymore. So
yeah, exactly.
All right. So last question for you, Steven. What advice would you give for any of our listeners who are thinking about going into the private brand game?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's pretty easy now to find an agency that does private brand design to some extent, right? Probably not solely 100% dedicated like maybe a Damon does, but there's so much of it out there now. I think for young designers, because this is kind of the mistake I made, was I wasn't open to it, right? So I think if you just, if you find yourself in a scenario where that is kind of coming across your desk as kind of what you're going to be tasked with doing, I think really having the open mind to say, you know, how do I execute these challenges to the best of my ability? Because, you know, I think it's very easy to say, you know, okay, well, this is only private brand and, you know, it doesn't deserve as much as I could possibly give. And I think it's just the openness to it. For me, I know that's kind of what got me early on, right? I was kind of using it as a stepping stone, but I just think I didn't have, the mindset to be open to that as a potential full-on career.
Yeah.
Yeah. And with the line blurring so much, I don't think in the future someone's really going to have to worry about that anymore. Like it's losing the bad perception it had, and it's right up there with everybody else, it seems like.
Yep.
You know?
And it's almost one of these niches that can still account for a lot of variety. I think people are scared of niching down because they think, I don't want to do one thing over and over again. But this is, it's a niche, but it's still like every project could be so drastically different. So I think,
well, and I think people fear that it won't be as broadly marketable altogether. Like it will just have all of its limitations, and they'll find themselves too narrow down that hole.
Yeah.
But I do have one question that's come up while we've been listening to you talk, Steven. This has just been so interesting. So I did at one time work at a creative agency in downtown Seattle, and it was brand focused. Mm-hmm. And so I do absolutely have recollection of the internal processes and the chain gang and what happened first, second, and who owned what. Well, I was hired specifically for a Nordstrom account, and I had thought, wow, I really want to interview with this agency. I get to have my hands on all these amazing brands. But that wasn't the case. They hired me for one specific account. And so maybe that's different. Maybe it's with respect to the agency that I was employed with that was the case. But would you say that those that are looking for positions with a creative agency and actively interviewing, that that's what's to expect? Or, you know, in a primary sense, I'm not to say that if, you know, people are coming in sick or on vacation for weeks at a time, that you won't have your hands dipped into other projects here and there at some time, but that by and large, you have your account that your employment is attributable to. Would you say that that's the case more across the board? I mean, I know you can speak to your company's situation, but maybe you have a little bit more insight on how that agency, that situation for an agency, brand agency, works altogether.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I can certainly tell you from the, you know, 8 or 10 branding agencies that I've kind of worked in along the way, is that, you know, the team structure of pairing a brand, you know, with a dedicated team is pretty consistent.
Yes.
But I, you know, and every once in a while there'll be a shuffle, whether there's a change on the client side. That's a natural time to kind of mix it up, because the relationship is going to start fresh anyway.
Yes.
So there are certainly natural times that within an agency, you'll move around. And I know we kind of deploy those strategies here as well so that people don't get bored.
But at the
same time, I think there's a lot of benefit to really the team structure as just a way for the designers to be super knowledgeable about that brand's DNA, right? And I think if you're that ingrained into like what makes that brand so special, that you are also constantly thinking about how it can evolve, as opposed to coming in fresh and new every day and saying, well, here's the challenge, and now I'm only thinking about that challenge and less about the brand evolution. So I think that's something that we struggle with a lot too, and try to do our best to make sure that we're, you know, always trying to push our retailers and our brands to like what's next, right?
Mm-hmm. It's what you make out of it, because you're right. You could get one of those roles and stay very static in just doing the same thing over and over again, but it's up to you to make things as dynamic as you can with what you're given too. So you're right, because every agency is going to be different with those roles, you know?
Yeah.
So absolutely.
Yep. It's really what you can do about it. And if you're, you know, if you're finding happiness and creativity with this kind of stuff, keep stretching the boundaries, you know? I'm assuming you even get to play around with like naming the brand sometimes at a certain point, right?
Yeah, I mean, we do it a fair amount, especially with the retailers.
And that's fun.
That's super fun.
Yeah, I mean, if they're a retailer who's not looking to put like their logo specifically on the pack and kind of creating those new brands from scratch, then that naming phase and kind of, you know, brand identity and development is certainly, you know, a big scope. So
yeah. I think that, you know, there was one question I always forgot to ask some of the other guests we had with this kind of idea. And I want to ask you, because I think you're perfectly situated with this being in a big team and everything, but to young designers out there and the people that are in their first few years, can you give them the idea of how important it is to be beyond just a designer and be a good marketer and a good, like you're saying, copywriter, being a good person with, you know, all those different things that are beyond just being a good designer? What's the benefit of having all that other stuff in a situation like you?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I think part of working for a larger agency is really the exposure to all those things, right? So, mm-hmm. you know, I don't think I was particularly open to it in the beginning of my career. But, it's kind of like as soon as you really kind of establish yourself and get your feet wet, start to, you know, I think there are certain people who will gravitate to kind of trying to own more. Right. And they'll start to take on those different things like, you know, maybe copywriting and kind of finessing kind of the romance copy that's on a pack. And I think if you can find the right environment that gives you the ability to kind of stretch, I think that's perfect. There are plenty of agencies that don't really allow that.
Yeah.
But I think the ones
where they keep it siloed.
Yeah. I mean, I think it all comes down to culture, right? And the people and the mix of people who are there. I think that the creative directors who are super secure in kind of what their value is.
Yeah.
You know, they'll let the people under them really kind of stretch and own it.
The minute they feel threatened, forget about it.
Through you.
Yes. Yeah. So that's,
but
you know,
and that's not to say, and we don't want to say be a jack of all trades and be, you know, wear 1,000 hats.
No.
But it's this idea that I feel like we've seen such a change in the last 10, 15 years where creatives, I feel, are more at the real table and not just sitting in their room getting direction, you know? And you're a good example of that you know, these creative directors are actually participating in the bigger talks and then, be, you know, representing their departments. And I love hearing more about that, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you know, if I think the worst thing that kind of ever happened to me early on in kind of the design career was that kind of feeling of being left out, right? Because ultimately, mm-hmm. you're tasked with doing the work, but you know, you're just not getting firsthand information. So,
right?
Yeah, it's a challenge.
It's been
but
a
I
good
think
change.
It's changing.
Yeah.
I think it's definitely industry wide, at least in my experience, it's been changing for the better, which is a good thing.
It's not Mad Men anymore.
Nope.
Thanks.
Don Draper is dead.
Don't ever say that.
Oh, he would definitely be dead by now. Trust me.
Yeah, pretty much.
He would have died.
I don't think
he
lived
80s.
Past 82, probably, yeah. Right around there.
All right, cool, Stephen. This has been great. What an interesting conversation. So, do you want to stick around for the listener question, or do you got to run?
No, I'm good. I'll stick around.
Perfect. So before we get to that, let's talk FreshBooks, baby. Stephen, use FreshBooks. Well, you're not a freelancer. You probably don't use FreshBooks.
Luckily, I leave the finances to people who are better suited than that.
I remember those days.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, I'm throwing down a challenge right now. I think this spot might just make you want to go back to freelancing so you can use FreshBooks.
Just because of FreshBooks.
Yeah. We love them. Like the best thing I can say is they just make it super easy. Cause none of us as designers, you're talking about wearing multiple hats. The hat we don't want to wear is like money nerd. Let FreshBooks do that. So they send the invoices that are properly branded with your colors. And they send them out. They keep track of when it's been viewed, when it's been paid, so that you just have a really easy at a glance. You just log in. You can see exactly where all your finances are. They've been rebuilt from the ground up. Their new interface looks amazing for designers. And you can send an invoice really professionally under 30 seconds. And one of the best facts is with FreshBooks payments, over 60% of invoices are paid within one day. That definitely did not used to be the case when I would just kind of send my own and you'd follow up and you'd not hear back. But the other thing I love about FreshBooks is they actually will be the bad cop and they will send those automated payment reminders that don't look like they came right from you. So you can still have non-awkward conversations with your clients when you're not talking about money,
exactly,
which is great. And, of course, we love their support. They a real life person usually answers in three rings or less. Mikkel can tell you all about that. and we've got a 30-day unrestricted free trial worked out for you, our listener. So go to freshbooks.com/deeplygraphic and enter Deeply Graphic Design in the How Did You Hear About Us section. Once again, 30 free days. Go to freshbooks.com/deeplygraphic and enter Deeply Graphic Design in the How Did You Hear About Us section. So do it. All right.
Do it.
Cool. So we've got a listener question. This one comes from Stephanie from North Carolina. And she says, in a previous episode, Mikkel suggested charging a service or payment processing fee for clients who choose to pay their invoice via credit or debit card. I'm curious about what that looks like on the invoice, especially now that I'm a FreshBooks user. Hey, this was not even product placement, but serendipitous. What amount goes on the digital invoice, the standard amount or the amount plus the processing fee? So I'm going to let you take this, Mikkel. I don't do this. So,
okay.
Yeah.
You explained it really
well. I like
that
this question is just following our little tidbit for FreshBooks.
I know.
It's all totally related. That's great.
God love you, Stephanie.
So this unfortunately did not entail a phone call to my Canadian friends with FreshBooks because I was able to find out this information on their website.
Okay.
So they have a support section with FreshBooks that just has a really handy table of what the transaction fees for FreshBook payments specifically U.S. and Canadian for U.S. and Canadian businesses. So they break it down based on Visa, debit, prepaid, Discover, MasterCard, Amex, and any other prepaid debit card associated with each. And so there's a chargeback fee of 15, flat 15 for all this. And you just go and you have a look at the transaction fee, which is by and large, it's 2.9% plus 30 cents.
Okay.
So I always
make sure you get that 30 cents in there.
Oh yeah.
I absolutely advise inquiring
makes a stickler
so that you're not surprised if your client contact wants to pay by credit card so that you can do the math before the invoice is submitted. So I don't submit these invoices by email. I actually prefer to do it. I export a PDF. I maintain correspondence over email to track everything. And I just have my calculator handy, and based on the total for the invoice, I take that 3%, I add it on plus the 30 cents, and then I send it off. And then I do ask, since the rate is different based on the type of credit card, which kind of card that they're going to use. I had to do this in a big rush not that long ago because mm-hmm. our client said, I can't use PayPal. I can't send you a check. Mm-hmm. We got to get this going faster because they had a huge print job that was pending, and they knew I wasn't going to expense it until the money came. Yeah. So this is a way for them to hurry and get the information to me. But there's other ways that you can threat.
you could just kind of put it in, right? I mean, kind of quietly. Yeah. But the cool thing, your system balances the books.
Does have a section where you can add line items. So if you opt to pay by credit card, the above is not your total. This is your total. If you're unsure and your client contact is not good with communication, and you're mm-hmm. just not going to gain response. So that way it's all disclosed. And if they don't pay the total associated with the line item that you create in FreshBooks, that's on mm-hmm. them.
Yeah.
And that amount will remain outstanding on their account in FreshBooks.
And you could do that with almost any service, because you're getting charged that same, you know, certain amount. And all it does is it balances the books for you better, because I've had a few where you get those payment like notifications, and I'm like, when did I ever come up with that amount? It's like some weird amount, like minus, it's like $1,000 minus like $3.65, you know? So it's like, you're like, what was that? So if anything, it balances your books a lot better when you do what you were recommending, which is great.
Which is adding it as a line item versus mm-hmm. just kind of asking them ahead of time, hey, you're going to do a check or credit card?
Both work. It just depends on the personality. It just depends on the relationship to me.
I feel like with me, I would almost rather just ask them and then just roll it in rather than have it be a line item. Because I feel like then that kind of almost could instill a little bit of bad will with the client. Like, oh, you're like,
for those that I totally trust and those that are completely honest, I might opt for the line item, but you're totally right, Wes. The safe way to go about that is to run a PDF export and send it by email after they have shared what their credit card type is, or the prepaid or debit card type is, or whatever. So do you, I mean, this link I can send, you can post it. I don't know.
Okay.
If you want the FreshBooks link, but it's super handy. I actually have it bookmarked and I refer to it often.
So is there a lot of like a big discrepancy between credit card companies, or is it more or less about the same?
It just fluctuates. It's very, very little, right?
One's
like something point something, and one's like just slightly different.
We know
how I think AMX, but AMX was. Yeah. She's got her little roster.
To a fault. It's true. So one thing that I oftentimes have to know is that, well, it's good to know for us, there are no monthly or setup fees. You only get charged with this when you make sales as a business person, right?
Right.
So sometimes it helps to contribute that knowledge to your client contacts, so they know that you're not trying to mess with them. You know, I try to just be as open as I possibly can. But I don't send this link to my clients. Like, no, I want them to know that I obtained that knowledge, and that you can look up these payment card types yourselves and the transaction fees. That's not specifically FreshBooks material. Yeah,
exactly. What do you have to say about it, Stephen? Sorry,
No, this is good. It's something that probably I don't have a ton of knowledge about. But if nothing else, I will say that this is super informative and informational for me as well. I think as designers, we all probably have our kind of little side hustle. And, as I start doing more and more.
Yeah, that was the question I forgot to ask you earlier, is if you do any work on the side.
Yeah, so it's 100% in a different realm, but we do a ton of...
He fronts a death metal band.
Yeah, I wish. That would be cool, but... I work with a couple people, and we do kind of large scale like graffiti murals.
Fun.
So it's super fun. It's kind of like just a whole new creative outlet, but that's kind of where it's informative for me about what you guys just talked about in terms of FreshBooks.
You're right.
Because at some point,
oh, that's amazing. You know, you must have no life.
You know, it's funny. The work-life balance thing is an interesting question, right? But, you know, I actually have very little free time, but I find the time I spend is more enjoyable. So.
Yeah. But what a great outlet. Well, I love your idea of the graffiti part of it, because it's like you got to be so ready for work, and then that's probably the best escape creatively.
Oh, I would imagine.
My favorite part of this
I'm going to start one.
Yeah, my favorite part of this is just the visual of sending an invoice for graffiti art.
Yeah.
Like, I know. Yeah, it's a far cry
from the... And here's a line item for the credit card processing. Yeah.
It's a far cry from the explaining to your parents why you were, you know, got in trouble for graffiti, and now it's something you can make money on.
Oh, totally. Oh, yeah.
Nice.
Funny.
Love it.
That's so cool.
All right, cool. Thanks again, Steven. This has been great. Where can people find you online? Do you have any, like, an Instagram or anything you want to throw out?
Your graffiti site.
Yeah, I mean, our Instagram, you know, we're still kind of putting it together. We do have one that we do for packaging, though, and it's called The Packagist. It's really just a package design Instagram account where we kind of, you know, review and you know, talk about things we like and things that work and things that don't.
Okay.
But yeah, it's really just a kind of a passion project.
Nice. All right, cool. Thanks again for coming on. This has been great. And I think that's about it for us this week.
But
we'll be back in another couple of weeks. So with that in mind, keep designing and catch us next time on the Deeply Graphic Design Cast.